This is the Quality News Network. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is calling for an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon and Gaza, telling the Security Council today that without one, humanitarian efforts cannot go forward to help the millions of civilians being impacted by the hostilities. He also condemned Israel's disproportionate use of force against Lebanon. For the first time since their barracks were bombed 22 years ago, U.S. Marines are in Beirut, this time to help in the continuing evacuation of Americans from Lebanon, where 300 Lebanese civilians have been killed since an Israeli offensive began 9 days ago. 15 Israeli civilians have also been killed. Israeli airstrikes are continuing today, as are the clashes between Israeli ground troops and Hezbollah militia on the Lebanese side of the border. In Washington, the House is expected to pass a non-binding resolution today supporting Israel and saying that Syria and Iran should be held accountable for supporting Hezbollah. The Senate passed a similar measure on Tuesday. In Iraq, another Marine has been killed in the Anbar province. 6 Iraqis, including 2 police officers, have died in other clashes. And 5 more people kidnapped last weekend at a Baghdad sports conference have been released unharmed. That makes 11, but as many as 20 are still missing, including Iraq's National Olympic Committee chairman. Iraq's migration ministry reports that in the wake of the increasing sectarian violence, more than 30,000 Iraqis have left their homes and registered as refugees just this month, bringing to more than 160,000 the number who have done so since February. And many more are believed to have either left the country or have taken refuge with relatives rather than sign up for aid or move into state camps. Iran has announced that it will respond on August 22nd to the nuclear proposals made by 6 nations and says it wants to resolve the dispute but is determined to go ahead with plans to produce nuclear fuel inside its borders. The State Department says that at least one Iranian representative was a witness to North Korea's recent missile tests on July 4th, further worrying Washington about the relationship between those two countries. President Bush today addressed the NAACP's National Convention in Washington, a speech during which he urged the Senate to renew the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The National Climatic Data Center says global warming has helped to make the first 6 months of this year the warmest ever on record. Meanwhile, a heat wave continues throughout Western Europe and much of the United States. A 500,000 power customers in Missouri and Illinois are still without power, the result of thunderstorms and high winds last night. And the National Hurricane Center has issued a storm warning for southeastern Massachusetts. This is the Quality News Network. Business is next.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
The Department of Agriculture is scaling back its testing program for mad cow disease to about one-tenth of what it's been for the past 2.5 years. The government says there's little justification for the current level. Apple Computer has announced a third-quarter profit increase of nearly 48% thanks to the sales of more than 8 million iPods. Pfizer's reporting a dramatically lower second-quarter earnings attributable largely to various hefty tax items but raised its 2006 profit forecast. Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, on the other hand, is reporting second-quarter earnings higher. Ford is reporting a second-quarter loss of $123 million. That's worse than had been expected by Wall Street analysts. Ford is blaming costs connected with personnel layoffs. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has announced $287 million in grants for AIDS vaccine development. The U.S. Institute of Medicine reports 1.5 million Americans are injured every year by prescription drug errors. Motorola says its second quarter was the best in history, helped by its shipment of nearly 52 million mobile phones and a 20% increase in sales over a year ago. And Toyota says that despite the fact that it has worked with General Motors on special projects in the past, it will neither join a proposed alliance between GM and Renault-Nissan, nor will it try and block that deal. Light sweet crude oil is trading this hour at $72.25 a barrel. That's down 41 cents. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are now down 8 points. NASDAQ is down by 19, and the S&P 500 is down 1. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
America, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, it happened. For the first time in 6 years of the Bush presidency, he actually vetoed a bill. No, it wasn't a bill with massive amounts, hundreds of billions of dollars in pork for bridges to nowhere in Alaska. Of course, it wasn't a bill that gave your federal taxpayer dollars to oil companies or pharmaceutical companies or Vice President Cheney's company, Halliburton. No, it was a bill that would have given relatively small federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, the kind that most scientists believe could be key to saving hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of American lives, because a stem cell from an embryo can do more things than a stem cell from an adult. It can actually become any tissue, any bone, any muscle. It's amazing. Of course, the president surrounded himself with the dozens of people who have chosen to make families of the 400,000 embryos set to be discarded by fertility treatment. I say dozens because that's all there are. Of the 400,000 embryos that are frozen because of excesses in fertility treatment, 128 to date have been adopted by families who believe that this is a life worth saving. That's not only less than 1%, it's less than 0.1%. And who can blame them? Most people want to have children of their own and with some genetic component. And those that don't, most of them want to adopt the children that are already here. But obviously I wouldn't prevent people from the one-third of one-tenth of 1% of people who want to adopt these frozen embryos and create a baby out of them. But what about all the kids that are already here and starving? What's interesting, of course, is this is a general problem or general predicament in the press, right? The president has this photo op. We know it from Mission Accomplished after the war in Iraq to the stem cell. He surrounds himself with the great photo op, but doesn't really mean what he says. The clearest example I can think of is, do you remember after Hurricane Katrina when George Bush went down to New Orleans, when they used up all the emergency generators to make the lights for his speech, even though people were in dire need of electricity, and George Bush promised he would do something about poverty? Well, of course, not only is he doing nothing about poverty, he's cutting programs that help keep people out of poverty and doing so at a massive rate. That would include food stamps, housing, Medicaid, community development grants, energy assistance. And he's doing so, of course, in order to give massive tax cuts to the rich. Now, that's something that doesn't get a lot of press, and that's been typical in this administration. After all, the number of poor people have risen dramatically. People, frankly, kids that could use adoption. It has risen to 12.7% of Americans. 1 in 8 Americans live below the poverty line. That, by the way, is $20,000 a year for a family of four. That's the poverty line. 1 in 8 Americans live below it. It's increased from 31 million to 37 million. But you won't see that in the press. You won't see that discussion. Just like, remember after the Supreme Court opinion, when the Supreme Court said, George Bush, you have to follow the Geneva Conventions. You can't just ignore international treaties. They are law. You have to treat prisoners fairly. You can't treat them like Saddam Hussein did. And George Bush said, maybe a week later, yes, we will follow the Geneva Conventions. That was on page one. But now we see on page 822, Bush is backing off from that, saying, we don't really want to follow international treaties. This has been the pattern all along with George Bush and the press. The press has been consistently giving George Bush a pass. Well, why are they doing it? I don't think it's because the press is Republican. Why is it that the press rolls over for Bush? Well, to answer some of those questions, I interviewed the author of a new book called Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. His name is Eric Bollert, and it was a fascinating interview, and let's listen to it right now. There may be technical problems in there. I'll tell you what, let's go to a break, and let's go and hear the interview after the break. So let's we'll take a quick break, and if you want to call in and comment anything I've said so far, feel free to do so. It's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. And coming back from break, we'll get to my interview with Eric Bollert, the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush.
This is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Listen, man, adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
Nah. You just got to find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4 and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers so that becomes an 8, too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage, when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Has the press been giving this president a pass? Have they asked him less tough questions than in past administrations? In the run-up to the war in Iraq, did they ask all the questions that needed to be asked? What's going on here? To answer those questions, I interviewed Eric Bollert, the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush.
My guest right now is Eric Bollert. He's the author of a topic that I am constantly wondering about, and I know you folks are too. His book is called Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. He's an award-winning journalist. He's written extensively about media and so forth for a number of different publications. Eric Bollert, this is the question, right? This is what everyone wants to know. You know, the Republicans complain about a liberal press,
right?
And yet we went into Iraq, and Judith Miller's writing all these stories, and everyone believed we had weapons of mass destruction. Why is the press rolling over for Bush?
Well, I think it's I think it's because I think the press has real rabbit ears in terms of the liberal media charge that's come from the right. And, you know, the conservatives have been banging on the press for, you know, going on 3.5 decades. And certainly this administration came in with a real pushback agenda. I mean, Bush essentially walked away from press conferences. His chief of staff announced the press was just another special interest. So this White House decided that they were going to sort of poke the press in the eye, you know, and just let them know who was boss.
Well, everything they've done, from these town hall meetings where they bring in all the supporters to paying off people who they claim to be reporters,
yep.
Maggie Gallagher, all of them. I mean, these are things, are these new things? That?
Oh, yeah, these are completely, you know, by the time the Armstrong Williams and Maggie Gallagher story came out in early 2005, it was almost like they had... They were so imaginative. I mean, these things were unthinkable. They were like
running out. Well, the Soviet Union thought of these things. I mean, they're not unthinkable.
Unthinkable in Washington. I mean, it was like they had run out of ways to humiliate the press. I mean, it's like they've been, you know, they got away from everything for 2, 3, 4 years, and then they think, let's pay pundits. Let's write them checks.
Okay, but Bill Clinton didn't get away with it,
no
right?
Way.
I mean, everything he did, I mean, every sexual thing he did, every...
Well, even before that, Whitewater, et cetera.
His hair, I just remember, I forget, Hairgate, right? Because he was on the plane getting
haircut,
his hair
right.
done, and that
Which
was a
wasn't true.
Huge scandal. I didn't even know that wasn't true.
And I point out in my book, because I went back to one of my favorites, the Washington Post mentioned it 50 times in 1 year.
And yet Bush, who chokes on a pretzel and has a history of alcoholism and apparent cocaine use, he gets... It's a free pass. What's going on here?
Well, there's obviously a double standard. I mean, to put it mildly, there's this titanic shift in the way the press covered this Republican White House and the Democratic White House. And again, I think it goes back to sort of two things.
It can't all be because they're afraid of being called liberals.
Well, look at, you know, in the 90s, how do you prove you're not liberal? You go after Clinton, and when you're on TV, you talk about scandals and you talk about these wild sort of what if scenarios, you know. Clinton's giving nuclear secrets to China in exchange for campaign
cash. I have people that call in that still believe that. I swear to you.
So that's how you got on TV. And if you want to go on TV now, you know, you talk about how, well, at least for the first 3 or 4 years, certainly, you talk about how resolute Bush was, how he didn't listen to polls, how he was so authentic. So it's a fear of the liberal media, but it's also a strong sense of careerism within the D.C. Beltway.
But you say to go on TV. Okay, now we all know about the Fox Propaganda Channel. They're run by the Republican Party.
You know, I'm talking about if you want to go on Hardball, if you want to go on CNN. I think there are spoken and unspoken guidelines about what you talk about. You know, 2003, 2004, if you're invited on CNN, you're a journalist, you don't talk about Iraq and lying in the same sentence. I mean, if you do, you're not coming back. I think there are
who
spoken...
Who won't invite you back? Who is in control here?
Well, the bookers, you know, the producers on the cable shows, and, you know, I worked for 5 years at Salon. I mean, you could not find a Salon reader on CNN, even though we were the equivalent of the Weekly Standard or the National Review. I mean, there's just this sort of narrative. There's just sort of this accepted D.C. culture. Republicans, far-right Republicans, savvy, smart, in the know. Liberal, somewhat even farther liberal, radical, out of the mainstream. How are we going to have them on? I mean, if you walk into CNN, almost every homepage is the Drudge Report. I mean, that's the perspective. That is the sort of, that's where they go for breaking news.
Now, this is interesting to me because, you know, a lot of Democrats will say, okay, we never watch Fox News, but CNN is not biased towards us, but at least they're even-handed. What you're saying is even CNN is not even-handed.
I have dozens of examples of CNN in the book.
Give me some.
Well, one of my favorites is the Downing Street memo from a year ago, May. You know, incredibly important story about how the Blair government was told 8 months before the war that the White House wasn't planning for a war. The White House had decided to go to war, fixed intelligence, et cetera, et cetera.
Fixing the facts around, fixing the policy.
That's right.
The facts around the policy.
And that they saw their job as essentially to justify the war. And if they went to the UN, it was going to be a way to trap Saddam into starting a war, certainly not a way to avoid a war. You know, that was published on May 1st, Sunday, London Times. The Blair government never disputed anything in the memo. No, to date, no one ever has. I mean, it's a legitimate insider memo. For 5 weeks, CNN broadcast approximately 930 hours in the United States, round-the-clock news program, 13 mentions of the Downing Street memo. I mean, it just simply did not exist. A week or two after the story broke, CNN was not alone on the Downing Street memo. I mean, everyone ran away from that.
New York Times, Washington Post?
I have an entire chapter on the Downing Street memo because I think it's such an illustrative example. But, you know, a week or 2 weeks in, Judy Woodruff she introduces a section, you know, they have the sort of the blog buzz, and they'd have a correspondent talk about what people are talking online. And she says, controversial, you know, Downing Street memo. And she never explains what it is. And she never explains why it's everyone's talking about it online. So, I mean, that's an example of...
But what's going on behind the scenes, okay? I mean, I think that we all realize this is going on, at least those of us that listen to progressive radio. Is it because... I mean, the people who call into my show, they say, well, it's corporations. They want power, and they give money to the Republican Party, and the media is all corporations, and they're all owned by GE, owns NBC, and Disney owns, you know. Is that what's going on, or is it deeper than that?
I don't think so. And it's funny because it's Lon. I wrote, you know, for years about media consolidation, and but I don't spend a lot of time on that in the book because I just don't think. I mean, I think those companies, in a sense, they want to be, they want to grow larger and larger. They want to have reductions in their limit ownership. So they're clearly lobbying the Republican Congress to lift ownership limits. But I don't think there's a direct quid pro quo. I mean, yes, you know, NBC is owned by GE, and obviously there's...
I mean, Ted Turner's supposed to be liberal, right?
Right.
Jane Fonda. I mean, come on.
And, you know, GE is obviously one of the largest contractors of the Pentagon, but... I mean, you know.
So what is going on here?
And the reason I don't deal with the corporate ownership is that I just don't. I mean, I've paid attention a lot of this, attention to this for 4 or 5 years, and there's just not even that many anecdotal suggestions. The beauty and sad part is, you know, Jack Welch, the chairman of NBC, wasn't sending memos down to NBC News saying, or chairman of GE wasn't sending memos to NBC saying, this is how you do it. This is how you do it. Again, it goes back to this sort of unspoken guideline. That people don't have to be told, you know, what is sort of out of bounds, or people don't have to be within the beltway who, you know, have a savvy career instinct, don't have to be told to stay away from the Downing Street memo. Everyone did it. I mean, if we go back to, every newspaper, every TV show, every network news show stayed away from it. So it's almost instinctive, and they're just following lockstep with the White House.
When I see the right-wing pundits on there, and they're saying, you know, they're calling Bush a liar. How dare they call Bush a liar? And then, of course, you have the famous words in the State of the Union speech that we know were a lie, saying that Iraq was trying to get nuclear weapons out of Niger, and, of course, the whole Valerie Plame Wilson Traitorgate is all about shutting up that. It's a fact, it's an admitted fact, that George Bush lied to the American people. Lied not in the sense of misstating a fact, but actually knowing the truth and saying it false. Recently we have, of course, the wiretapping of all Americans, where he said, I only use a search warrant, and then it came out about the international, and then he said, well, I only do it international, and now we know they're looking at all our phone records. It's a fact that Bush has lied to the American people, and yet you can't seem to say Bush has lied to the American people on air.
That's a perfect example, because the right wing yells, you know, they're saying liar, but very few people are saying liar. I mean, maybe some pundits are saying liar.
I say it.
But I mean, in terms of like mainstream journalists, I mean, they will not use that phrase on TV. And in fact, I wrote after the invasion in the summer of 2003, when it was clear there were no WMDs, there were these rash of articles on how Bush hadn't lied, he had merely exaggerated. New York Times did a weekend review story. And I thought that was interesting, because wasn't it during the 2000 campaign that basically Al Gore was not qualified to be president because he exaggerated?
That's right.
But if Bush merely exaggerated, it's about the WMDs. Again, the double standard.
So we all agree it exists.
Yeah.
Help me out here. If it's not corporate conglomeration, what is going on? I mean, reporters, if you talk to them privately, will tell you Bush is a liar. But publicly, they won't say it. So who is restricting them, and how are they doing it?
I think it's really self-imposed. I mean, I think it is a group culture within the Beltway. Again, I go back to the Downing Street memo just because it's so obvious. I mean, how could no one from the Washington Post, New York Times, AP never filed a single dispatch about the Downing Street memo? So you think it's groupthink, or you think it's some sort of cult? I mean, how could they? I mean, they're all journalists. They're all very smart. They all realize that this memo is newsworthy, and yet no one writes about it and covers it?
Some reporters I talked to, they gave me a very interesting response. They said, this is old news. We know Bush lied about the war.
This is important.
And so, even though we never reported it to begin with, we all knew it was true.
But this is very important.
So we don't need to tell you.
Because talk radio and the bloggers went nuts over this Downing Street memo. And after a month, the mainstream press finally said, okay, we'll deal with it. It's old news. And I go in great detail in the book, and they said, everyone knew we were preparing for war. You know, there were congressional hearings. That's not what the memo said. The memo said, we're going to to war, and I try to go back and find...
And fixing the intelligence
right,
around the policy.
And the sort of between-the-line explanation with the Beltway reporters and pundits was, well, we knew we were going to war. Everyone knew it. Well, why didn't you write it in real time? Try to go back and find the NBC News.
They didn't.
News
they wrote about Bush says, I will do anything I can to prevent war.
Over and over again. Almost every public appearance in the fall of 2002, how he wanted to avert war, the Downing Street memo proved him to be a liar, and the press refused him to call him on
it. So let me ask you this. Bush is now at between 29 and 32%. It is post-Katrina. It is post he's spying on all of us. Gas prices are skyrocketing. Everyone sees sharks in the water. Has the press changed now, at least?
It's funny. It really hasn't. I mean, a lot of people thought after Katrina there would be a shift, and I wrote at the time, you know, I didn't think it was going to happen, and I don't think it really did. And again, in the fall, in the spring, in the you know last few months, down to 31%. I think the press feels better about where it is. I think it feels like it's being appropriately skeptical, and I think it would point to certain stories that have been tough on Bush. But I mean, you know, what sort of profile and courage is it to be tough on a president who's at 31%? And I just don't think it is true. And I think we. You know, if you go online, I mean, every week there are examples, just egregious examples of just, like, wildly inaccurate and wildly one-sided reporting that it just is stuck. And, I mean, Chris Matthews, last week he had the...
He's supposed to be the fairest guy. He's supposed to be the guy that's most on our side.
Yeah, although if he's on our side, we're in trouble.
Well, I think we are in trouble.
But, I mean, you know, he had one of Condoleezza Rice's, like, right-hand men on, and he said, you know...
Hadley?
No, but someone else, and at the end of the interview, he said, come back anytime, we're big fans of yours. And you just think, it's a small thing, but you think, we're big fans of yours.
Well, I'm wondering if what it is that when you have power, people want to placate that power, but then it didn't happen under Bill Clinton.
Exactly.
So,
you know, and again, you know, if you look at the polls, people would say, well, of course, after, you know, September 11th and the invasion of Iraq, Bush went up in the polls, so of course the press is going to be timid and pull back and then going to reflect the popular opinion. You know, let's go back to Clinton during impeachment. 60, 65, 67%. He had record high poll ratings.
Right.
At no point in that last 18 months did the press ever contemplate the notion that it should be going soft because the American people gave him such high marks.
Well, let me ask you this, because you raise an interesting point about whether it's post-September 11th. I don't know whether you've studied the 6 to 8 months prior to September 11th in the Bush presidency with post to see whether there was any significant change.
Well, you know, if you go back to 2001, Bush got incredibly good coverage during the election. When we talked about how Al Gore was essentially depicted as not just an exaggerator, but really a pathological liar. I mean, he was, because
he couldn't remember what his mom's medication
was
with regard to whether a dog, you know, it's the same medication as a dog.
It was the most blatantly dishonest coverage I think any major candidate has got in the last half century. So Bush had good coverage going into 2000. You know, the Washington Post, John Harris, who was probably one of the best reporters, May of 2001, you know, Bush is in month four office, wrote a story basically conceding that there had been a dramatic change in the way the press was covering this White House versus the Clinton administration. And then after 9/11, I mean, obviously they pulled back, and I think it makes a certain amount of sense, and it's to be expected. But I open the book, we're looking at the press coverage from 2005, because I think that's when he got some of the most timid and soft-peddling press, and that was, you know, 4 years after 9/11. So I don't think 9/11 in Iraq explain this. I think there's something deeper going on.
What can we hope for the future? I mean, you give very persuasive evidence. You know, for those of us that we're already concerned that we don't control either House of Congress, we don't control the courts, we don't control the presidency, they're violating our constitutional rights right and left. We rely on the Fourth Estate, the only people we have left, the press, to protect us. If they're in bed with the administration, you know, what hope do we have?
Well, that's really what has happened. I mean, the press's job during the Bush administration was so important. I mean, with Republicans taking control of all branches of government, and particularly Congress, essentially washing its hands of the oversight responsibility. I mean, there was essentially none. And it really was left to the press, and they walked away. So the question is, where does the hope come from? And I think, you know, I think progressives and folks on the left have woken up to the fact that the media is the message.
I mean, all we have are blogs. That's all we have.
Well,
is internet,
God.
Radio, blogs,
but,
podcasts.
Know, I know it's depressing, but you think, my God, what, you know, where would we be without them?
Right.
You know, I mean, the Downing Street memo never would have been a news story. I mean, literally. I mean, that saved the day. So, you know, there's such passion there, and there's passion on talk radio, and I think it can translate. I think Democrats, particularly Democratic leadership, needs to understand this issue. There's a DNA thing. I mean, the Republicans play hardball, and the Republicans bring their and Democrats bring their hands. And the Democrats have to understand they're getting crummy press. They've been getting crummy press for 15 years, and they need to play ball.
They don't have to be dishonest about it the way
the Republicans are. But you need to play ball and not be afraid of what they're going to
see.
It hasn't worked for 15 years.
When I worked in Congress, we would hold press conferences, and no one would show up, literally.
Yeah,
we would talk about the damage. I worked on the Homeland Security Committee, and these things, the Dubai ports incident, we were talking about ports in 01,
right,
in 02, when Bush threatened to veto a bill that would protect America's ports that got no press.
Well,
so, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
How... It seems to me that the people we need to talk to, I guess, are reporters at the Washington Post, at the New York Times. If we're getting some mea culpas from them, are they realizing what they did and changing now? Or?
Well, I think they realize that the free passes are over. I mean, they realize that they're going to be held to a certain standard. And maybe it's just blogs, and maybe it's just their email box being filled up. But you know what? That worked from the right for a long time.
So if people write a lot of letters, and people write to reporters, and
I think,
Judith
yeah.
Miller got fired, so that's
yeah,
something, right?
I mean, you know, and the criticism from the left is always very factual. The media criticism from the right is really from people who hate journalism and want to delegitimize it, completely knock it down. The media criticism from the left and in my book is from people who love journalism and want to do better and think it should be more responsible. Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, the fire and brimstone gets their attention, but I think they understand that checking mechanism and it's not going away. Unfortunately, it's just they've got a really good, cushy gig, and why would they want to change it, and why they still revere Republicans and they still revere Hardball. And obviously it's going to take some Democratic wins, I think, so they can control the House, control other places.
Because everybody loves a winner, I guess.
Well, and then they can sort of set the agenda. I mean, you talked about having press conferences, no one showed up. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, they just absolutely, you know, Democrats controlled most of the power in Washington in the 1990s. Republicans didn't have any problem getting their... often sort of kooky, you know, conspiracy theories.
No, because they would buy up all these, set up the Heritage Foundation and all these pseudo-institutions, the Washington Times owned by
Absolutely.
Reverend Sun Young Moon, which I still am amazed when anyone could say the Washington Times and not say Reverend Moon in the same sentence, because you have a crazy man who thinks he's the Messiah, and yet they're treating it like it's a respectable newspaper. Tony Snow, the current press secretary, used to work for a crazy man who manipulates people and claims he's the Messiah and is anti-Christian. How come no media has focused on that very basic fact that no one can dispute?
Because it's just, you know, it's just frowned upon, and it's just Republicans are not put under the same scrutiny. And, I mean, even like a paper like the New York Post, which is taken seriously in Washington, I mean, the paper is it's a joke in terms of a journalism
sure.
enterprise. And but, you know, it's funny. I was on CNN once. I was going to be on a weekend show, and they told me what the topics we were going to discuss. And they called me like on Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday they told me they were going to change the topic. So I thought it was something really random. And lo and behold, later that day, it's front page of the New York Post. I mean, it sets the agenda, and it's a joke of a newspaper. How does that happen?
It's interesting. The same thing's happened with me on Fox News, but I expected it from Fox News.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Eric, this is a great interview. I'd like to have you on, frankly, for a full hour discussing these issues, along with some of my callers, instead of this pre-taped interview. But let me just ask you as the last question, to get into the minds of some of these reporters, and I know you've talked with a lot of them, and these are reporters, I think, for the most part, who want to do the right thing,
Absolutely.
Who want to report the issues, and yet the New York Times finds out about this domestic spying thing and doesn't report it for a year.
For a year.
Is it, you say it's sort of self, you don't think it's the editors pushing down the reporters. You think
No.
it's mostly self-restraint.
Oh, well, let me, I don't think it's like memos from the top down, but I do think the editors and senior producers do make a difference. Let me give you an example. I mean, for years I've watched the White House press briefing with either Ari Fleischer or Scott McClellan and now Tony Snow. And, you know, 1, 2, 3 years ago, you would watch it on C-SPAN. Very tough question. really skeptical, not letting them get away with sort of these non-answers, and you think, wow, I mean, tomorrow's story is going to be really hard-hitting. Then you pick up the newspaper, you watch the network news that night.
They don't mention
all that skepticism.
Only the Daily Show shows those briefings.
Well, I mean, not even the good, hard, factual questions that are not being addressed. That stuff just disappears. So in that sense, I think, you know, the hands of the senior editors and the senior producers, they just sort of give it a nice gloss.
Why are they doing it? That's the bottom line.
It's the culture that you do not want. I mean, look what happened to Dan Rather. I mean, they botched that story. They did not authenticate the memos. His career is over. I mean, what better
example? And the story was essentially true. They just had false memos to talk about a true story.
I have a whole chapter on Bush and the National Guard and the press coverage of it and how they ran away from it again and again. It's absolutely true. It cannot be disputed. He lost his job. I mean, that show's not even on the air. The producers are fired. I mean, that sends a message. If you go after Bush and you screw up, if you go after conservative and you screw up, your career is danger.
I mean, you can claim Clinton killed Vince Foster, murdered the guy, and those people are still around.
Jeff Gerth, the New York Times, got a Pulitzer. I mean, he hatched the entire Whitewater.
He got a Pulitzer for that.
Not for that, but for even less accurate. So if you went after Clinton with these crazy conspiracies, you won awards. If you went after Bush and you tripped because you didn't authenticate the memo, your career's over. I mean, it sends a pretty clear message to people. Again, it's sort of a spoken and unspoken guideline. This is what we talk about. This is what we don't want to talk about.
So who's in charge here? I mean, that's what my listeners want to know. If it's not the corporations, it's not the editors,
you know,
what is the mindset? Is it that people fear the conservatives because they have a lot more money? Is that what it is?
They fear conservatives. They admire a winner, most importantly. They admire Harbaugh. And it's a cultural careerism thing. I mean, if you get tagged as being, you know, too far left or, you know, battling Republicans all the time, or if you're on the hit list for, you know, the Heritage Media or any of those right-wing media groups, it has real consequences. It absolutely has real consequences. If you're on the hit list of, you know, the ACLU or some of the, you know, it's a badge of honor. I mean, you've prayed that around the newsroom.
It's a fascinating subject. It's something we've been talking about for 3 years. The author is Eric Boehlert, B-O-E-H-L-E-R-T. The name of the book is Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Eric, I hope you'll come on for a longer discussion.
I'd be happy to.
Because my listeners really care about this topic. Thanks so much for coming on The Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
I told Walmart to sell the Easter egg dye kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg. We decided they can't be with it, that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. And God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. And so now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I've got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, back to The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. The topic today is the press and how they treat George Bush and the Republicans. And we've talked about treatment of Bush. Now let's talk about treatment of Tom DeLay by two people who are trying to get their message out. Mark Birnbaum and Jim Schermbeck are the co-producers of a new documentary, which I hope you go out and see, though I admit it's hard to find. It's called The Big Buy, Tom DeLay's Stolen Congress, and I interviewed them as well just a few weeks ago.
My guests right now are Mark Birnbaum and Jim Schermbeck. They are the co-producers of The Big Buy, Tom DeLay's Stolen Congress, which has opened in cities across the nation just 3 weeks ago. A documentary, hopefully there will be in a city near you very shortly. Gentlemen, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let me ask you, I know that Robert Greenwald's been on our show before. He's done a number of terrific shows and all kinds of things. You're working with him on this show as well, is that right?
Yeah, this is the first movie that Brave New Films, Greenwald's company, has actually bought and not made from scratch itself, but distributed on its own as a result of what we were doing down in Texas, yeah.
We really thought that the grassroots kind of distribution plan that he has, the house parties around the country, really suited our film. When DeLay was indicted, our film got a lot of publicity, and we got some calls from different kinds of distributors, kind of a more traditional Hollywood route, going to Sundance, that whole thing. And Robert called and introduced himself and told us about Brave New Films and said he was interested in being our distributor, and that's what we chose to do.
Interesting. I mean, I would think most people would have chosen the Hollywood route. You felt that this was the better route. Is that because the people who watch this kind of film are more educated and more likely to care about political things than the ordinary Sundance viewer?
It just seemed more likely to get seen this way by most of the people who are interested in seeing it. And also, the idea of it becoming a central part of a campaign that would lead to some kind of change in how we fund elections was also appealing. We didn't just want to release it in a theater and let it go back into the woodwork. We wanted it to actually leave a mark and inspire some people to try to change the system.
Well, let's go right into the content, because I know that's what my listeners care about. I've done a number of shows in this broadcast on The Hammer, a.k.a. Tom DeLay, and how he basically ran his bribery operation, which I don't know what else you call it. It may well be legal, some of it, but it's a quid pro quo, right?
I mean, that's system of legal bribery, right? What it's called.
Basically, you pay Tom DeLay to get the legislation you want, and you can pay him $1 million, and you get back $1 billion in return in taxpayers' money. Is that sort of the heart of how it works?
Pay to play.
Pay to play. So give me some examples of this legal, this bribery, legal or not.
The example in the film has to do with the Westar Corporation. Tom DeLay came to Texas and set up the TRIMPAC, Texans for Republican Majority Political Action Committee. And he started doing this in 2002. His purpose was to win seats in the Texas state legislature in 2002 so that in 2003 he could push through mid-decade redistricting. He redistricted Texas, redrew the lines, so that in 2004 he could get new Republicans elected for what he hoped would be a permanent Republican majority in Congress in Washington.
I recall at the time I worked for the Department of Homeland Security, at that time he actually used a Homeland Security plane to track down the wayward Democrats who were trying to...
Some Texas legislators had to flee Austin in order to try to shut down a vote on his redistricting plan. About a month later or sometime later, the senators had to leave. They went to New Mexico.
Right, I remember.
But eventually it got through.
Okay, but a lot of that is politics. It's hardball politics. It's tough politics. What I want to talk about is money. I mean, you say Tom DeLay's stolen Congress.
So I was going to tell you
about... Yeah, who is paying for Tom DeLay, and what did they get out of it?
So in one example in the film, the Westar Corporation from Kansas was told that in order to get a meeting with Tom DeLay, they had to contribute $25,000 to the Texans for a Republican Majority. And Ronnie
in order
Earle,
to even meet with the guy.
Ronnie Earle is the Austin District Attorney in Travis County, who, because the state capital is in Travis County, has jurisdictions over crimes that occur in the state capital. This is a huge responsibility that he's got. And he's in our film saying, you know, that he's saying that $25,000 for FaceTime with Tom DeLay, and it's very clear, it's spelled out very clearly.
How did Tom DeLay ask for this money? I mean, what's the smoking gun? What's the proof?
Well, their lobbyists, of course, were up here in D.C. working on the energy bill, and his staff was meeting with their staff, and it was very clear if they wanted to play with Tom DeLay, they had to pay into one of his funds, and at that point, taking over the Texas legislature was a real priority, so he was funneling his corporate money into the Texans for a Republican Majority.
You think his staff's going to testify in the criminal indictment, the trial of Tom DeLay?
It depends what kind of pressure is brought on him.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Scanlon and Rudy have both been indicted now. They may turn or not. He employed very loyal folks, so it's really hard to say if they'll turn or not.
Let me ask you about Jack Abramoff. When you think of Tom DeLay, about the first person you think of is Jack Abramoff, who's been involved in so many of these bribery scandals, and I believe funded a lot of Tom DeLay's trips to Scotland to play golf. What was this relationship between DeLay and Abramoff, and how did both men profit from it?
Well, I'll say that we have a clip in the film that actually I haven't seen anywhere else yet. It's Abramoff addressing the Young Republicans Convention. Isn't that what it was called? College Republicans. And he says, thank God that Tom DeLay is the Republican majority leader. And then he looks at the audience and he says, Tom DeLay is who we all want to be when we grow up.
Oh, that's a pretty scary thought.
Yeah, they had kind of an incestuous relationship. Abramoff was one of the people that helped him funnel corporate money into his various enterprises. The Texas PAC was only one of those, as you know. There was Arm PAC. There were a number of different, the family charity that set up house near Capitol here and was funneled money from the Russian mob, it looks like now,
wow,
and so forth. So there are a lot of shell games going on. What this film doesn't even attempt to run all that down.
It's very hard to.
And you won't get a definitive story about all that till like five years down the road. What we try to do is take what happened in Texas and show people how it happened, why DeLay's in trouble, and how it's affected the rest of the country. Because those five votes that he got in Texas,
sure,
and sent up here to D.C. affected the energy bill, affected CAFTA, affected these budget resolutions. They've all been by five votes or less.
And if Democrats don't succeed in taking Congress, it may be because of those five votes.
Absolutely. They're the only gains that were made in 2004.
Otherwise, the Democrats made gains. Let me ask you this. One of my favorite Tom DeLay stories, and I don't know if it's in your film or not because I haven't seen it, though I will go out and see it. I promise. I'm just waiting for you to bring it to Washington. But one of my favorite stories is during the Medicare bill. They held the floor. They had open all night. They didn't close the vote after 15 minutes. And Tom DeLay is rumored to have gone on the House floor and twisted a bunch of arms. Congressman Nick Smith of Texas has said he offered $100,000 to his son's campaign if he changed his vote. And I remember, what I remember from that, because I was working in Congress at the time, was Robin from North Carolina, the moderate Republican who was crying on the floor because he was twisting his arms so hard because he represented a textile industry. And he didn't want this, but was Robin Hayes, I think he's his name, and Tom DeLay, you know, twisted his arm so hard that he was crying because he wanted to help his constituents, but he realized that his loyalty to Tom DeLay was ahead of his loyalty to his constituents.
Oh yeah, DeLay holds a grudge. I mean, if you don't vote with him on a bill like that and his bill loses, you'll never see the light of day on your legislation again. You're out in the doghouse after that.
It's hard for people to understand, people who haven't worked in Congress, the power that this one man had. I mean, you could have legislation, I remember, that had 400 supporters in Congress, but if Tom DeLay wasn't on board, that legislation never got a vote. Let me ask you this. I know how it was. My listeners know I used to work in Congress as legislative counsel. I know how it was, but I don't know how it got to be. How did this pest control man from Texas get to be the most powerful man in the United States Congress?
Well, first he found Jesus.
Did you explore that?
Yeah, first he found Jesus. In our film,
it's Jesus' fault, basically,
well,
here.
Don't go there.
Go ahead.
No, he was a very small bit player in Texas when he was in the legislature there. Jim Hightower in her film calls him a piece of furniture based on a report that came out from a magazine that ranks people every year in the legislature. So he was not a big player until after his first term here. Then he found the Lord somehow, or as Jim Hightower says, the Lord found him or whatever. And he became kind of a pet project of the right-wing Christian coalition. And his association with that group really propelled him, along with this scheme to use corporate money in a way that had never been done before. And he was one of the architects, as you know, of the whole K Street Project, kind of the corporatization, the institutionalization of corporate money in Congress.
Right, the K Street Project, of course, that is a way to take lobbyists and make them partisan in a way that they hadn't
been before.
Absolutely.
I was just reading the other day something. I'd spent 3 years researching this. Something I did not know was that the Republican majority in Congress in the House was determining who was going to be committee chair based on the amount of money they had raised for their colleagues.
Wow.
Right? That's what, not seniority, not in terms of expertise, but how
pure
much
cash
money you raise for your colleagues in Congress. So that's how it gets to be as bad as it is right now.
So how much money did Tom DeLay raise, and who did he get it from?
He got him cheap. He really did. $3 million?
$3 or $4 million total in Texas.
Bought the Texas legislature.
That's awfully cheap.
And ultimately,
well, I remember when congressmen, you know, they cost $10 million to put a congressman in your pocket.
Remember, he was just state legislative races, which were not, you know, big funded deals. They were small districts. They were low profile affairs.
Right, so you throw $50,000 at a race in the middle of Texas, that guy's probably going to win.
And funding him at the end of the day was the Christian Coalition or corporations or Abramoff or some combination of
all of the above.
So, in your view, will he actually be convicted by an Austin jury?
I think a lot depends on whether this conspiracy charge is going to be upheld by the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas. It's on appeal right now.
Describe what you're talking about, the money laundering or something else?
No, there's two charges against the guy right now. One is money laundering, and the other is conspiracy to violate the Texas law against corporate campaign contributions, which is a law that Texas and 16 other states share.
So, it's been around 100 years, I think.
It's exactly right, since the turn of the century. And so the conspiracy charge is a lot easier to prove. In terms of the state law that he broke, it's a lot more clear-cut than the money laundering charge, at least on the outside, not knowing what evidence Ronnie Earle has. If that charge sticks, then I think you're going to see a conviction on that charge. The money laundering charge, I'm not so sure, because we haven't seen all the evidence for that.
Now, where that all stands right now is that that charge that got thrown out is on appeal. Ronnie Earle has appealed it to the Texas Criminal Supreme Court, I think that's what it's called, and they have to decide that, whether that charge stands or not. Once that's decided, the case
before
comes back to Austin.
Before he be tried, he has to decide.
The case comes back to Austin, then they have to decide venue. The defense has appealed for change of venue, motion for change of venue.
That's because they don't want it in Austin.
Right, and outrageous prosecutorial conduct. That's a 30-page motion before the court. We occupy 2 pages of that motion. The big buy is mentioned specifically in that motion.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's quite a challenge. You know, to be hated by Tom DeLay, you all must be so proud of yourselves.
Oh, he's used the film now twice to raise money for himself.
Well, that's not so good. Let me ask you this. You know, maybe because I'm a Democrat, I feel kind of like an abused spouse. But, you know, we've been beaten down so many times. If Tom DeLay, and I hate to even say these words out of my mouth, but if he, God forbid, is acquitted, could he come back to politics? Or is he at least the reign of Tom DeLay over?
Yeah, it's just these charges right now. We don't know what's coming down the pike in terms of federal charges.
So you think there'll be bribery charges and things like that?
I have no idea where that is going. But now his wife and his daughter are both in trouble as well, are being investigated at least by the FBI for accepting money from lobbyists for work they may or may not have done.
So let me ask you the broader question. Tom DeLay, an easy man to dislike, an easy man to know the power. But what has he done that's beyond? Is it just Tom DeLay? When I was there, he ran the whole Republican Party. What is the legacy of Tom DeLay, and how is it going to last in our legislature after he's gone?
Well, in the film, we draw a direct line, as well as connect the dots for people about why he got in trouble and how. It's also to make the point about what the impact has been in the country. So CAFTA, the energy bill, these budget resolutions are all because of those 5 votes that he brought back from Texas, plus the institution, what we were just talking about, the institutionalization of corporate money in Congress. The way you do this is to accept corporate money and funnel it here and funnel it there. People like John Doolittle in California or Bob Ney in Ohio, who we also profiled.
Don't forget Duke Cunningham in
Duke
San
Cunningham.
Diego.
These are all folks who are schooled in Tom DeLay's methods and who are carrying on his practices even in this Congress while he leaves. Those practices continue.
Let me ask you another question. This one's tougher. Some of my listeners will say, okay, all right, I'll accept that all these Republicans are corrupt. I'll accept that Tom DeLay even ran a criminal enterprise out of the House. But Democrats are too. You got William Jefferson.
More unsophisticated about it, though. Putting $90,000 in your icebox is not exactly the same thing as funneling money in a more sophisticated way with banks and so on.
I'll accept that Jefferson's completely corrupt, but is there a difference among the parties? Is Jefferson the exception where Tom DeLay is the rule?
I think it depends on who's in power. It's the abuse of power that they have that enables. I mean, it's the power that they have.
So it's the majority party, actually, that can do the damage.
In our film, Ronnie Earle, the district attorney from Austin, says that both Democrats and Republicans walk up and down Congress with their hands out, demanding what he says it's almost like protection money. And he says that it's a problem for our country that's every bit as insidious as terrorism.
And I believe the only solution is public financing. I
yes.
assume that you
I
agree
that
with that.
I think that is correct. I've been an activist all my life, and it's true that if we don't do something about this problem, the debate is getting narrow and narrow. We don't have a voice anymore. So we're trying to use the film for this event on June 27th, Clean Money Day, where people are going to be having house parties around the film and then asking their congresspeople, how do you stand on public financing of elections? How do we get big money out of the election process? And we're hoping that it will spark some real interest in moving toward that goal.
We've made a film about campaign finance reform without ever once uttering those words.
Interesting.
Which caused people's eyes to roll back into their head. So, Clean Money Day. CleanMoneyDay.com is where you can get information about that. That's June 27th. And our website is TomDelayMovie.com.
And I assume they can find out where their local theaters are playing the film. And
right. There's a lot of information on the website.
You can buy the DVD right now.
Okay. And you can do that right there on your website.
Yes. TomDelayMovie.com.
TomDelayMovie.com. Well, I, for one, am definitely going to check out this film, and you should, too. Mark Birnbaum, Jim Schermbeck, thank you very much for coming
thank
here on
all.
The Inside Scoop.
That's TomDelayMovie.com, and you really should check it out because, as I argue on my website, RadioInsideScoop.com, the past is a prologue. You cannot understand the future unless you know the past, and that's why I wanted to explore two very different things in terms of the press. One, how the press rolled over for George Bush, did virtually nothing, allowed him to say whatever he wanted to. And I think Eric Bollard's fascinating. I really do have to have him back because he describes how the press is so afraid of being tagged as liberal that they bent over backwards not to challenge the administration. And you even had the New York Times condemned by the administration as this awful liberal newspaper. Of course, its reporter Judith Miller was one of the main offenders in accepting without challenge all the administration's lies, from its crazy curveball Iraqi defector that gave him so much false information about nuclear weapons, all the way to holding for a year the fact the administration was spying on us. So it's very fascinating, and I really hope you'll take a look at Eric Bollard's book. And for Tom DeLay, it's interesting. A listener just sent me a link to show me that Tom DeLay's PAC has been shut down. And while that's a good thing, it really won't do much at all. The FEC, the people in charge, you have the fox running the hen house, right? It's only because of this massive indictment by a very brave prosecutor, Ronnie Earl, in Texas, that the feds are even taking a look at this, and now all they have to do is set up another PAC, and the money will flow. What's interesting about all of this is that this is an administration that is corrupt from bottom to top. It's all about pay to play. This is an administration that cares about giving your money, my money, taxpayers' money, to people that give them money. And all we can do is, heck, you know, that's why I'm here. That's why the Head On Radio Network is here, to give you the news the government does not want to know. And it's tough to do that. We live in a world, as Eric Bollard pointed out, where Dan Rather lost his entire illustrious career by reporting a true story. And if you don't believe the story about Bush and the National Guard is true, just go to my website, RadioInsideScoop.com. I have the actual documents linked there that show him disobeying a direct order to show up in the National Guard. I did stories about this a couple of years ago. Dan Rather did an accurate story, did not get all the sources right, and was drummed out of the media, while you have people like Richard Mellon Scaife, the author of the